Holly Toe, so Hatifa Karina Walters, Mita Chata Sioke. Good afternoon and welcome. And I just wanted to say I'm really honored to be here, and I wanted to pay my respects to the indigenous people of this land and also to the spirit of 1848 Caucus for having given me this opportunity to share our information with you today. I'm going to talk a little bit about historical trauma and discrimination, distress, or microaggressions. And I wanted to first start off with this picture, and this picture is Nanawaya. It's our origin stories, our creation stories. A lot of them come from this sacred mound. It's in Mississippi. And a lot of people don't think about historical trauma and think about space and place and how it's linked to land, and how that's also linked to body and embodiment. So I'm going to wind back around to this a little bit later. When I introduce myself, I acknowledge that I'm enrolled in the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. And so this is where we come from, or one of the stories that about that. Oh, wrong way. Okay, so the driving question for some of the data I'm going to share with you today is, how do traumatic stressors and events become literally embodied? How do we embody these events? And how does this manifest in our physical and mental health, as well as in our risk behaviors? And I'm drawing from an Indigenous stress coping model that we've been working from, and so I will be talking today about some of these factors, historically traumatic events, and then I'll be talking about microaggressions. And importantly, to also acknowledge, we'll be talking about cultural protective factors, family, culture, community, things like that that actually buffer against the impact of these historically traumatic events and everyday discrimination or microaggressions, and the impact that it has on our wellness and our body. And when I'm talking about wellness, I'm not talking about just body wellness. I'm talking about the whole package, mind, body, physical, mental, spiritual, as well as the environment in place. And in the words of Nancy Krieger, and all her work on body embodiment, one of the things that we're going to be drawing from is just as bodies, as she talks about, bodies tell histories and stories, just as bones illuminate important information about the everyday lives of our ancestors, our contemporary bodies also express these stories, whether or not they're in our consciousness. And Nancy talks about this in her earlier work, and I've always thought about that, because the whole issue of measuring historical trauma is it's not always in people's consciousness, and so I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But it's really critical that we do study these things, how the embodiment of microaggression, distress, and historical trauma, and the corresponding health consequences, because it allows us to determine the forces driving the intergenerational patterns of disease and health. But there's a major debate, even among American Indian, Alaska Native social workers and our communities. And it's a debate that says, you know, historical trauma effects, maybe they really aren't a big deal once you consider really lifetime rates of traumatic event exposure. Maybe it's the childhood sexual abuse that really is causing the health outcomes in childhood, and historical trauma is really negligible once you account for that. That's a reasonable question, and it's a question that we've been trying to struggle with and figure out how do you disentangle some of these things. I think some of the epigenomic evidence is really interesting, which actually argues that, yeah, well, there is something going on intergenerationally in terms of the transmission of traumatic stress and how it can literally become embodied. And in some of that research is some of the work coming out of the neurobiological toll of stress on descendant generations' health, particularly with cardiovascular disease and hypertension. So embodiment, what I like about it is that it reminds us we can't exclude social, historical, or cumulative experiences and impact on wellness. And when people say the life course perspective, I'm always like, well, whose life? You know, in terms of looking at intergenerational and historical trauma. So how much is, you know, previous experiences of our ancestors continue to reside in our bodies? I'm drawing from the work from the Honor Project. It was funded by the NIMH, a six-site national study on gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, American Indian, Alaska Native health. I'm going to use the term Two-Spirit for today. And I can talk a little bit more about the methods. I'm going to just briefly say you had to be American Indian, Alaska Native to be a part of this. You had to be eligible for enrollment in your tribal nation, or if you weren't enrolled, you had to be at least a quarter American Indian, Alaska Native. You could be heterosexually identified, but you had to have the same-sex relationship within the past 12 months. And I'm not going to go into the details of our sampling design, which is pretty complex because that's like trying to find a red rainbow needle in a haystack. But we did respondent-driven sampling within these different cities and communities, and then we randomly selected people within people's networks, and we oversampled for younger folks as well as transgender folks, and also people who are low identifying as gay and low identifying as American Indian. I know that's going to, okay, anyways, we can talk about that later. but this is gives you an example at our Seattle site, the extent of our networks, and we did a lot of network analyses as well. And from a public health perspective, if there's a disease in our community, you could see how it could spread very quickly. A little bit about the background demographics. So the data I'll be sharing is based on 447 folks, primarily enrolled in their tribe. Average age was almost 40, but a very impoverished community. Despite having a little bit more of a higher education than the national Indian samples that you see for general populations, income level, this was household income level in these cities, right? New York City, San Francisco, LA, we're not talking, right? So we're talking about pretty poor. Okay, so let's get to historical trauma. It's like talking about historical trauma in 15 minutes. It's making me nervous to even try to do that. But historical trauma is different than intergenerational trauma. And there's some overlap, but I really want to make this distinction. You can have intergenerational trauma that can be passed on. You can, for example, your ancestors were exposed to a horrible famine. And that was through no fault of a group, a body of people trying to impose something on somebody. It was an environmental disaster that happened and had an impact that you can see how it could be transmitted over generations. That could be an intergenerational traumatic stressor. Historical trauma, though, is actually conceptualized as an event or set of events that are perpetrated on a group of people, including their environments, who share a specific group identity, whether it's nationality, tribal identity, or whatever, they share a group identity, who's been selected to be to have their culture or their life ways or their people either exterminated or disrupted in some way. There's a genocidal and ethnocidal intent with historical trauma. And I think that's really an important, explicit piece to say. This isn't an accident. A good example is Hurricane Katrina. A lot of folks initially thought just the hurricane itself was a historically traumatic event. I'm like, no. The hurricane itself was a community-level traumatic event. So these historical trauma events target a collective. So yes, on a collective sense, you could say it's a huge traumatic event. It became a historical trauma event for a lot of community members based on government's lack of response and the attributions that were made about that. And then you've got that event, but then you've got historical trauma response, the response to the events that got triggered when the Princess Cruise Lines offered all their ships to come and take families and separate families, where you're going to be separated from primarily black families, separated from their children and not knowing where they're going to be shipped off to. And all of a sudden, everybody's like, no, I'm not getting on a ship. And Princess Cruise Lines didn't understand, because with their intentions, they thought they were being helpful. But what they didn't realize is that really, given the conditions, triggered a major historical trauma response in terms of slavery. So the thing about historical trauma is individually, each event is profoundly traumatic. But taken together, usually these events don't happen in isolation. There's usually more than one event. Taken together, they constitute a history of sustained cultural disruption and destruction directed at particular communities. The trauma can be held personally, could be transmitted over generations. Even family members who have not directly experienced the trauma can feel the effects of the event generations later. So that's the discourse in our communities. That's the stuff that people are talking about. The resulting trauma is often conceptualized as collective in that it impacts a significant portion of the community, and compounding as these multiply historically traumatic events occur over generations, join in an overarching legacy of assaults. Okay, you with me on that so far? All right. Okay, there's different issues in research, though. We talk about historical trauma as if we all agree on the definition and what we're talking about and how we're going to measure it. There's kind of four ways that I see it's been talked about in the literature. One is an etiological factor, a causal agent. You have an event that causes this poor health outcome. Historical trauma is also talked about as a particular type of historical trauma response, as a response or a syndrome to these cataclysmic events. It's also used as talk about as a mechanism or pathway to transfer trauma across generations. And then there's HT related stressors, which interact with proximal stressors. So disentangling some of that. So the simultaneous use of historical trauma for all of these categories, I think, is in part made it difficult to cogently really theorize and measure historical trauma. So I just wanted to put that out there. And in terms of the research on the impact so far, you know, scholars have noted that there's individual and communal level impact of HT events on native health. On the individual level, this includes impairments in family communication, mental health symptoms such as PTSD, depression, substance abuse. At the community level, collective responses include disruption of traditional customs, languages, and practices. But despite exposure to these kinds of events, many and most people do not manifest psychopathology. So I want to put that out there. Just because your family or you have experienced historical trauma doesn't mean you're going to have a poor health or a poor mental health outcome. And I think that's an important piece to put out there. Emerging research actually indicates that the very areas of Native culture that have been targeted for destruction, identity, spirituality, traditional practices, may in fact be some of the most important sites of resistance in our communities. And so I think some of the work needs to also flip the question and really look at it and say, you know, how have people survived despite the fact that they've been exposed to these historically traumatic events? And some of our communities do different things to signify these events and work through them or acknowledge them. A good example is the Trail of Tears commemorative annual walk that we do with my tribe. We walk a small part of the Trail of Tears. I'm going to get back to that in a minute. So we've done focus groups. We've talked to lots of different communities about what do we mean by historical trauma. What does that really look like? Genocide, as I've talked about. I want to also make sure that you know I'm talking about environmental and spiritual traumas are part of historical trauma events. These are buffalo skulls. General Sheridan said the best way to kill the Sioux, and that was his word, not mine, was to kill the buffalo. And a lot of people mistake this for meaning an interruption in people to be able to access their food resources. And it's much deeper than that. It's about interrupting a people's ability to fulfill their original instructions. It's a deep spiritual assault as much as it is a physical assault on the people. So that's one of the hallmarks of colonization and historical trauma. Historical trauma is designed to interrupt the community's ability to fulfill their original instructions. The boarding school period, let's get a little more contemporary, that was a really devastating period in Native history, and we're still feeling the effects of that to this day. In the late 1880s, the government said the best way to kill the Indian is to save the man. Forced a number of our communities, hundreds of thousands of Native kids, to be torn away from their families and put into boarding schools. This is not Andover, folks. this is Carlisle, and it was run by Pratt. General Pratt was the former director of prisoners of war for Fort Marion Prison in Florida, and that's who they put in charge of Indian education for our kids. Lots of torture, a lot of physical abuse, a lot of sexual abuse in these communities, in these schools. So this was pretty devastating. Very young kids who really didn't have the opportunity to be parented by their community, their families, or their culture. Good example, here's Tom Torino when he was put into boarding school, Carlisle. This is him 3 years later. And the explicit agenda was to assimilate Native people so that they're no longer Indian, basically. And to if you were found speaking your language, you would be severely punished. During the same period, they put in the Court of Indian Offenses for communities. If you were found practicing your cultural traditions, you could be imprisoned. And so pretty devastating period. Kids had their heads shaved. It was very confusing because they were literally taken from their families and put into these schools. If families fought it, their families could be imprisoned. Some people did go to prison for that. And some children, in the narratives that come out of these experiences, people said that they were really confused because in some Indian traditions, when you cut your hair, it's a sign of mourning. And so when children had their heads shaved, when they arrived at the school, they thought their parents had died. So what's the impact? The colonial impact is disruption in our ability to fulfill our original instructions, the disruption in our relational ways of being, right? You don't have an opportunity to know and learn and to nurture those relational ways of being, which are so central to Indigenous well-being. Disruption in our spatial obligations and relationships, and that has to do with a good example with interrupting our relationship to the buffalo. If you're Lakota or Dakota or Lakota, any of those tribal folks, the term is Buffalo Nation. The buffalo are seen as relatives And there's obligations so to those relatives that are central to space and place. There's a breakdown of boundaries, literally physical, mental, and even down to the spiritual and land. And part of the thing is about the colonial impact is the intention to create systems of dependency. So, for example, when Native people were put on reservations, you no longer could, there were military establishments, literally you were not allowed to leave, they're a form of prison. And during that period, you couldn't hunt, you couldn't go and eat and gather foods, but what the government did was they gave commodities and said you have to become dependent on this kind of food to survive. And so now we're seeing three generations, four generations later, we have some of the highest rates of diabetes and obesity in the country. So, but part of undoing all of this is to dismantle these systems of dependency on the colonial nation state and really kind of recognizing our original instructions as our foundation for our healthy living and life ways and health promotion. So how do we restore those or continue to grow those when we do have them and restore relational ways of being and our responsibilities to one another and future generations. And part of the narrative that we talk about in our communities from a practice perspective is where did we learn this behavior? If this is a behavior that's destroying us, where did we learn this? This isn't something that's central to our culture. So those are some of the things that we're talking about on the practice level. So to microaggressions, discrimination, distress, so something a little bit lighter but still has a major impact. As we know, single event acute trauma does have negative health effects, but it's the everyday chronic discrimination that could really have long-term health consequences. So let's talk a little bit about microaggressions. Daryl Wing Sue has done a lot of writing on this, and we've been doing our work on this with our own community as well. It came out back in, I think it was 1999, I was doing a PTSD measure with the Native community and in New York City, and one guy said, you know, we're not post-traumatic anything. Every day walking down the street as an Indian, I got something going on that just drives me crazy. So he goes, what do you have for that? Do you got a measure for that? And I said, well, no, we don't, but let's make one. Let's talk about it. What does that look like? What does that taste like? What does that feel like? And out of that, we actually created a microaggressions a measure. And these are the chronic, everyday injustices that all of us endure, but I'm going to focus on Natives, and you know, I think a lot of groups can relate to that. Oh, man, I'm running out of time. Okay. It's the interpersonal and environmental messages that are denigrating, demeaning, or invalidating. These are verbal and nonverbal encounters that place a burden of addressing the incident on the person who receives them. That's what's so stressful. That's a huge stressor. When you have a microaggression encounter, when you're at McDonald's, and then all of a sudden you're left over to get the white person who's standing behind you in line, they're asked to call forward to get it, and you're sitting there going, okay, all right, wait a minute, hold it. Is that because, you know, you start going through that in your head, it puts the burden on you to figure out, are you going to confront it? If you confront it, what are you going to run up against? Denial, conflict, white guilt, and someone's crying on your shoulder and you're taking care of them. I'm in social work. That's what happens a lot. And either way, you're burdened with having to work through whatever the situation is. And it's stressful. And there's three types. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about that in 2 minutes or less. There's micro-invalidations. A good example is being told by a non-Native person that he or she was an Indian in a past life. Good images. It includes environmental messages, micro-insults, behaviors that demean identity. So what does microaggressions do? They cartoonize us, and they make us not real. If we're not real, then we don't have to be dealt with. Micro-assaults, those are the more classic ones, straight up, you know, more the perpetrator is aware of what they're doing, and that's the other burden, is the burden falls on the recipient to decide the intentionality of the perpetrator. And, you know, then you have to, in this situation, perpetrators usually know it's the person who says, oh, yeah, it's a bad joke, but lighten up, get a sense of humor, that kind of thing. Good example is when I was on faculty, I had a colleague of mine that asked me to come dressed as an Indian for teaching a lecture, a guest lecture in her class. And I was like, wow, did she just say that? And I'm like, okay, I tell you what, and I kept talking to her, but she was getting worse, she was digging deeper and deeper, and finally I said, I'll come to class dressed as an Indian, and she's like, oh, great, and so I came to class in my best suit, wore nothing that could mark me as an Indian, and to her in her mind, and I walked in, I said, class, I'm dressed as an Indian, we're going to do a whole lecture on microaggressions with her there. Okay, so let's cut to the chase, I've got 1 minute, basically. We found in our sample that historical trauma events really did have an impact. And what we did to address that debate is we controlled for military combat exposure, we controlled for lifetime sexual abuse and physical assault, and we also controlled for their own historically traumatic experiences in their lifetime. So we only took their ancestral experiences over generations. What we found was that after controlling for all those things, we still had an effect of historically traumatic events on PTSD and depression. And what we also found, I just want to highlight from that, is disruptions in ways of relating. Those events that caused disruptions in, like, boarding school, ways of relating to family and community, was more linked to depression than direct attacks. Direct attacks on community, place, or family was linked to PTSD. Chronicity of events matter, too. The more chronic the events over generations, the more poor mental health. And then back to my land issue at the very beginning with Anawaya, loss of land was directly related to both poor physical and mental health. So I'm going to end there. There's more I could tell you about, but you'll have to read my publication now. All right, so thank you very much.